talk about something that I've been actually writing about for a really long time. And the thing that the talk today does is kind of, my book came out in, 2016, maybe 2015. And obviously, you know, we're 4 or 5 years later, so a lot has happened since then. So if you want to get a backstory, I'm only going to briefly go over things that are basically in my book. And when a lot of people, when I first started writing about Common Core, a lot of people didn't even know what it was. They didn't know where it came from. And so there's a lot of kind of informational just getting and gathering and distributing. Now people have kind of some sense. They've had experience in their schools. They've read some articles about it. And so what we're able to do now is look kind of retroactively and have a lot more information about did the big scary predictions or the big positive predictions on people of both sides of the debate, basically, you know, who was right about their predictions about what Common Core would do to American kids? And unfortunately, the dissenting voices that I featured and pursued in my writing, turns out that so far, the data that we have shows that they were absolutely right, that we spent billions of dollars and American kids are doing more poorly. So I'll put kind of, I'll just give you all of that information today, and that's something that's not available in my book. But what my book really does is goes into the history of how something like this could happen, which I'm also going to talk about today as well, because as I said yesterday, I think that understanding Common Core will help you understand that the kind of government we have is not the kind that you think that we have, and why that's a real big problem for America. So what gentleman yesterday mentioned, the deep state, well, that's the administrative state is kind of the more academic term for it. But basically, bureaucracies and lawyers run America and really reduced our ability to have representative government. And I think that's a problem because I love America. One of the chief things about America that makes us great and unique is self-government, representative government. And once we lose that, we literally lose our country. So also understanding the Common Core issue will help you understand why American education is actively undermining our founders' ideals and seems to be impervious to reform. I mean, those of you, I'm laughing here because I'm not very old, but I feel like I'm very old. So those of you who have been around, the globe a few more times than others, a couple of decades of paying attention on you, will know that conservatives have been complaining about American education since at least the 1930s, actually. Before that. And our complaints have been getting louder and the problems have been getting worse. And we've had now since the 50s under Eisenhower, we've had lots of attempts at education reform. And while we've been doing education reform after education reform after education reform, the schools have been getting objectively worse. And if you look at any not just in terms of academics, which is that's really rigorously demonstrated by a lot of measures, but also in terms of the culture. We talked a lot about the cultural problems last night. So I am of the opinion that if your complaints and your activism and your attempts aren't working, it's time to try shifting your strategy. So I really think what Common Core should do is be a breaking point where we stop and say, huh, our complaints and our attempts at stopping things like this haven't worked. Everything's only gotten worse. We need a new strategy because our old one is a failure. So we'll talk about more about that kind of thing at the end of the talk. But first, what I'm going to do is kind of tell the story of Common Core, what it is, how it came into place, and then I'm going to draw a couple of lessons from it, and then I like to talk about, in practical terms, what to do about all of this. So I first heard about Common Core. I'm just looking at my next slide here. Okay, I'll look at my next slide first, and then I'll tell you more about how I first heard about Common Core. So I think I like to talk about this, just a brief overview for people about the two main different kinds of education, because the knowledge of it is not really well done, and I think being able to kind of mentally visualize it helps you understand, here's what I want, here's what I don't want, and kind of really broad ideas. And it also helps you say when you go and look at a textbook or look at a teaching method or go into a school and see what's happening, you have some way to kind of distinguish, oh, this is effective and this is good and this is going to be most likely to help kids versus this is kind of going to lend itself towards mushy minds and more propaganda and less learning among kids. So literally the ineffective way of teaching is called progressive education, and that's not, it didn't start as a political term to apply to the political left. It started with the progressive era in America. The people who were kind of tied with the Roosevelt administration, with the Woodrow Wilson administration, who were the education reformers of the day, called themselves progressives because they were literally trying to change centuries of types of ways of doing education. So there's the traditional, what I would call classical liberal arts way that the West has educated its young for 2,000 years. Very well proven, that's this kind on the right. And then there's the progressive modern, what I call contemporary, one that was basically been around in public school, or not actually only public schools, also a lot in private schools, even homeschools, that style of teaching that's just only been around for 100 years. So 100 years is a long time. I wasn't around 100 years ago, but still in the overall scheme of history, 100 years is still pretty new. Anyway, so let's start with what are hallmarks of a classical liberal arts education of the kind that actually created the founding generation that created America. It's focused on the great books. You see saturation of classic literature, what some people call the canon. That's C-A-N-O-N, not N-N-O-N. I'm an editor for the Federalist, and all the time people will write canon referring to books with two N's. And I think, oh, you poor people, nobody ever taught you better. They can't help it, you know. No, nobody taught them better. They've heard the word and they don't know how to spell it. Anyway, but it's focused on the great books. You don't spend time on scholastic garbage. And I don't have any problem with reading that on your own time for fun, but we're talking about when school picks stuff to prioritize, to spend time on in the classroom, why would you waste your time on, Sammy Plays in the Snow? You might as well, you should spend time on the best and introduce kids to the things that have stood the test of time and offer an enduring value. That's what's worthy of your limited class time with children. Classical liberal arts also, and this is a divide between the left and the right, politically, a huge divide in the world between whether you think that human beings have a fixed nature and whether you think they're what they call tabula rasa. They have no nature and they can be basically manipulated by government and society. So fixed human nature would say something like God made us, and he made us in a certain knowable way. Obviously, we have different personalities, we have different talents, but for example, people, something that people will always do is we are always going to sin. So a fixed human nature is we're not naturally good. We need social institutions to help shape us. And we are prone, we both have opportunities to do vice and to do virtue, right? So that's saying there is a thing that is a human that is definable and knowable, and it is stable across time. The progressives don't believe that. They believe that people are, I was going to use the word tabula rasa again because it's like the philosophical term, but that means a blank slate. So you come into the world basically shapeless and formless, and society can take you like a little lump of clay and mold you into whatever it wants. So therefore, if something goes wrong with somebody, blame society and demand giant social restructuring and government programs. It's never the individual's fault. There's never anything wrong with him. He never made any choices that led to bad outcomes. But it's all society's fault. And so therefore, if we make society perfect, then we can make people perfect. So basically, obviously, for those of you who are thinking that's an anti-Christian idea, because only God makes people perfect. Government and society can't do that. We only endure and muddle along the best that we can. Okay, so the other thing, a hallmark of a classical liberal arts education is the cultivation of virtue. And so that's really tied with the idea of a fixed human nature, because it says there is a thing that we can know that is good behavior, good and right and excellent action. And there is a thing that we know that is vice behavior, that's evil behavior, it is wrong, it should be discouraged. And so you can either teach people to do what is right or teach them to do what is wrong. Relativism says the exact opposite, right? Well, what's good and bad is in the eye of the beholder. If you feel it is so, it's your truth. So we are seeing the results of that, right? If every man is a god in his own eyes, then we basically have social chaos. Okay. The other a hallmark of a classical liberal arts is a content-strong science instruction, and it's also morality, civics, and duty-driven. So it says that you are not put on this earth to self-actualize, to follow your dreams. You have responsibilities and duties to to your parents, to your community, to your creator. We will teach you what those are and how you can fulfill them, and we expect you to do so. And then last of all, it is historically very been controlled by parents and communities. So there's no involvement of something like a federal government, or let alone world organizations like United Nations, UNESCO. It's directly accountable to parents and the local town community. We're not even, you know, I live in a city that has about 200, 250,000 people. That's way too big for this kind of concept. We're talking about the people who are surrounding in the neighborhood is probably a good way to look at it. Okay, so progressive education, it's kind of the polar opposite of all this. Focuses on random contemporary books with no enduring value, just trying to get kids to read whatever, because like that, we can't even get them to read anything, so we'll just toss whatever cartoon thing at them is possible. So relativist human manipulation, I talked about that, talking about social engineering, saying we can perfect people using government. The aim is of cultivating political correctness. So because we can't really have a values-free society, what relativism does is pretend that there's no right and no wrong while secretly imposing right and wrong in the terms of political attitudes. And so that's why you see political correctness then basically becomes the arbiter of right and wrong while saying, oh, I'm not right and wrong, I'm just correct and incorrect, okay? they don't teach logic in progressive schools either. The science, and for that, so for part of, tied to that, the sciences are then often politicized and watered down. You see this, for example, in there's a national science curriculum or standards. I actually use curriculum mandates because standards implies that they have a high standard of excellence, and they don't. But what they do is substitute for content knowledge, for actually knowing, you know, your periodic table, for learning about actual physics concepts. What they do is instead is basically suffuse the curriculum with things like environmentalist propaganda. Again, the idea is to cultivate correct attitudes rather than to teach what is true, right, good, and beautiful. It's also therapeutic and consumer-driven. So the idea being that we just want you to be happy, you know. And for them, happy isn't the high philosophical term of long-term happiness, because you have learned and to become a virtuous person, because as Aristotle said, actually in the long run, you are happy when you are a virtuous person, right? It's not temporarily happy to restrain your passions, control yourself, and do all that, but in the long run, it does make, if you've ever taken care of a little child for long term, like I have, you learn that it doesn't make your child happy to say, no, you can't scream at mommy when you don't get what you want. However, if you have over 3 years, made sure that the child knows you're not allowed to scream at me when you don't get what you want, that child is happy, orderly, you know, fits into the family, and it's the same thing with grown-ups. You know, if we control our passions, we are in the long term happy, even though, well, we had to spend a couple of years denying ourselves, well, for me, it's chocolate and other exciting things. It's hard to look at a child and say, your desires are malformed, they're not very good, I'm going to teach you to desire something better, you're not going to like it right now, but when you're 8 years old and you can control yourself and you're not hitting me when you're almost as big as me, my 9-year-old son is, you know, up to here, you know, I mean, you're not hitting me when you're that age, we are all much happier for it. And then the last thing that is a hallmark of progressive education is it's bureaucratic and centrally controlled. So we see all of the aspects of progressive education are embedded in Common Core. And I first started, let's just go through kind of a timeline of American education to understand how Common Core got here, as well as understand through this timeline, this is basically also the timeline of America's classical education tradition being watered down increasingly and converting to a public progressive education paradigm. So the federalization of American education started in the 1950s. I didn't realize this when I was looking into Common Core, but as I mentioned, President Eisenhower started sending, the first thing that the federal government did was using the pretext of military involvement, because this was the Cold War era, everyone was really nervous about the Soviets beating us in the space race. So the federal government said, okay, we're gonna spend a lot of money on science and math so that we are better at science and math, so we are beating the Soviets. So that's the first kind of toe that, the, and The justification there was also, back then they cared more about the Constitution, and the Constitution says that education is a right reserved to the states. But defense is a federal, you know, absolutely a federal prerogative under the Constitution. So they pretended that this education initiative was defense, so therefore the federal government could do it. This was back when they at least used pretext for, you know, breaking the Constitution. Now they just do it, and then, like, Nancy Pelosi laugh when somebody says, you know, where's the Constitution say you can do this? Oh, don't, you know, ha ha, don't give me that. Okay. Anyway, so in the 1960s, it was under President Lyndon Johnson's New Deal. The Education Department was passed as a part of his dramatic expansion of the federal government. And as a part of that, there was created the law that's basically the biggest federal education law, called ESEA, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And what that basically did was develop the model that the federal government uses for all of its unconstitutional spending, which is to take a bunch of money from the states and then say, you can have your money back if you do what we say that you have to do with it. And that's the way that the federal government runs American education, for 9 pennies out of every dollar. By holding all the rest of it hostage from the people that it took it from, unless they follow what a bunch of bureaucrats think they should do. So that happened in the 1960s, and there was a huge backlash against that. And President Reagan actually, you know, again, for those of you who are there or have read any history, he came into office, one of his key campaign promises was to repeal the ESEA and eliminate the U.S. Department of Education. It has no proper constitutional authority, not helping kids, and all it does is give bureaucrats and teachers unions control over all of American education. Well, he made the mistake of appointing a man who supported federal involvement in education as his first education secretary. And so when he sent that man out to do what was supposed to become a report that would turn into a big justification that would underlie, oh, okay, we did this big report, we went all through the country and we found what a big, you know, what a useless pile of garbage USDOE is. And therefore, we are proposing legislation to get rid of it. That report turned into what you might have heard of as the Nation at Risk report. So this education secretary literally took what the president told him to do, which was find a basis for justifying to the American public why we're going to get rid of this institution, and instead turned it into a justification for keeping it. And so the Nation at Risk report was an alarmist report demanding education reform, and the implication was, I mean, and it did actually provide, and this is the same thing that happened with Common Core. They went and they found evidence that American kids were really not doing well. We thought they were doing well, but compared to other countries, or in a lot of the statistics, were artificially inflated. You know, and if you looked on objective measures, American kids were doing, even in the 1980s, a lot worse than they had been in the previous generation. All of that was true, but the conclusion of the report was, therefore, we need more federal involvement and more federal control, and this is such an emergency, we all have to be heard in the direction of solving the problem. And the exact same pattern was followed with Common Core, looking at the real degradation of the American education system, and rather than saying, oh, the federal government has been in charge of education for the past 50 years, maybe that's a major factor here and we could repeal that, instead they said, no, we need more of the same thing that has been causing American kids to not be doing well. So, and at that point, from Reagan until, I mean, I would say until today, although that consensus is cracking, the elites in both parties started to push what I would call corporate education reform. And when I say corporate, I don't mean necessarily, I'm not anti-enterprise, but I am anti-cronyism. So what I mean by corporate is people who do not have kids, do not teach, and aren't local taxpayers get together in a room and decide how all those other people should be, how their lives should be run without their input, and then take their money and impose it on them. So the elites in both parties were basically, that was their style of education reform from the 80s onward. And the first kind of hallmark of it was something called Goals 2000 in the 1990s. So President Clinton pushed that. It was and it actually was passed. It was an increase of the federal involvement in curriculum. But it's important to note that it wasn't just Clinton. I mean, George Bush Sr. was also a big favor of that, and so was George W. Bush. So it was absolutely bipartisan failure to create this and push this mentality. So then, of course, everybody is really aware when George W. Bush and Democrats, based on that kind of consensus, that elite consensus, passed No Child Left Behind in 2001, which represented another massive increase in federal spending as well as federal control. What that did was, one of the big things that it did was create this regime of annual testing that all the schools now have to do in order to get their federal funds. So in grades 3 through 8 in math and reading, as well as once in high school, all public schools that get, if they want federal money, they have to do federal tests. There were supposed to be, the tests were designed to fail, like they were expecting American kids to do poorly on them. And so therefore in the bills, once the kids failed, then that was supposed to trigger all of these things such as school choice to the kids, you know, teacher re-education, and all of us who are familiar with legislation at this point are aware, you know, what always happens is the money always passes and the sanctions never kick in. I don't even think they were good sanctions in the first place, but the Republicans were supposed to want the accountability part, and the Democrats were supposed to get the spending part, and the Democrats got what they want and the Republicans didn't, which is, again, another pattern. I don't think that what the Republicans wanted was wise. However, it was a deal, and the deal only worked out for one side of the political aisle. So when all of that failed, crashed, and burned, when these tests started ramping up in the late 2000s, the failure of kids on that was used to push Common Core, just like the Nation at Risk report was used to push keeping the U.S. Department of Education. And so now what I'm going to talk about today is how the Common Core failure is evident just a decade later after it's been passed. So, and the part of the reason that I do these timelines is that, I mean, people don't talk about it anymore now because it's basically a done deal, right? We're a decade into Common Core. Repeals at this point are kind of pointless. You know, the whole education system has pretty much been switched over. I think it's really important to notice the means by which basically American people and their representatives were not involved at all in creating a wholesale complete switch of the American education system. And if a bunch of bureaucrats and a president can just take a pen and a phone and change what your schools have to do with, you know, reading and math, they can do whatever they want any time in the future. And nothing has structurally changed about what caused Common Core to be imposed on us that would prevent that from ever happening again. So, I mean, again, we get an Elizabeth Warren dropped out of the race. We get a Bernie Sanders presidency, Joe Biden presidency. All of the skids are greased for they decide A, B, or C needs to happen in public education. They can just roll out the exact same, the exact same plan that was used to do Common Core and, you know, pick their topic, pick their poison. The American schools are going to fall in line. Republicans in Congress did not use their majorities to solve that problem. They pretended to solve that problem while doing nothing about it, which is kind of, you know, what Congress has been doing for the past, 60 years. Okay, so that's why I go through this timeline. So actually, Common Core began with a bunch of private foundations that receive a lot of taxpayer dollars through grants. The important part about them being private organizations is there's no open records laws. You can't go to their meetings. You can't find out, for any local school board meeting, any state school board meeting, every state has what they call a sunshine law. I can call up or send an email request, and legally they are required to give me materials that, you know, that the school is teaching, any meeting notes, any recordings that they have. All of the information is public knowledge because it's a public body. That's not the case for a private nonprofit organization. So that completely eliminates our ability to see who made what decisions, what the reasoning was, what their real plan is, you know, and all of that is hidden under wraps when this is basically government is outsourced to these private organizations that we often fund but we can't control. So the Gates Foundation is the largest one in the world. It has something like $1.2 trillion in assets. That's as much as the federal government spends an entire year. It's as much as the entire economy of some very small countries. You know, so Gates is, you know, almost, I mean, he's not as rich as God. God has everything. But, you know, the point being, he's a mega rich dude who gets to a lot of things because of his money. So he and the Broad Foundation, Eli Broad, is another similar mega billionaire who has a foundation. And they put a huge amount of money behind convincing state lawmakers and state boards of education and basically, you know, creating reports and funding all of the work of creating Common Core, funding even the tests that a lot of states use for Common Core, funding teacher training, you know, you name it, they bankrolled it related to Common Core. And so they also paid off what are two other private organizations called the National Governors Association, NGA, and the Council of Chief State School Officers. That's a national private trade organization of state school superintendents. And so thanks to all this money, they started this project in 2008. And then when President Obama was elected in 2008 and then came into office in 2009, that really turbocharged their project. I have, thanks to a number of researchers who talked to Gates Foundation employees, so we have quotes from them, anonymous, but you know they're verified and they went on the record for a report put out by a sister foundation. They literally said, you know, President Obama being elected was like the kind of the way that we were able to take our project and make it national. Like that was the triggering moment. That was just what we need. It put all the energy behind this Common Core thing. And so literally several people from the Gates Foundation against federal ethics rules, they were waived in order for them to become Obama administration employees. And the Obama administration, basically the Gates Foundation's education vision was just copied and pasted into the Obama administration's education vision. And then the Obama administration used its federal power to make all the states do what it wanted. And the way that it did this is, again, the same thing. What it said to the states was during the recession, 2008-2009 recession, they said, states, we have here a pot of $1.23 trillion. You want some of that money? Well, we have four criteria we're going to use to judge whether we'll give you some of that money. You all can compete for it and submit your applications to us. And one of the criteria was adopting Common Core. Another one was having national tests, basically Common Core tests. And another one was doing teacher training, an evaluation based on the results of the Common Core tests. So three out of the four criteria for whether they would have a shot at this money is all related to whether they did Common Core. So, and you notice this was in February 2009 that this was released. And I want you to notice it is more than a year before Common Core was ever published. So this Obama administration went to states and said, you have to do this, pass this bill to find out what's in it. It didn't even exist. It wasn't in draft. So they required the states to send notes to the federal government saying, we promised to do this thing, and nobody had even gotten a look at what this thing was. It was all based on all these promises to the federal government. Okay, so that's what this timeline basically talks about and illustrates, is that nobody knew what they were doing before entirely they all signed onto it. You might think it's pedantic, but I think it's a complete outrage that your state education officials, and by the way, I think it was only two states, and they did it after the fact, ran Common Core through their state legislature. What happened in most of the states was the chief superintendent, the state superintendent and the governor signed promises to the federal government that they would do Common Core, but nobody voted on it. It was never a bill anywhere. There was no transparency. It was just like signing contracts with the federal government. And I don't even know how that's legal. Like the way that we're supposed to pass laws is, you know, someone proposes a bill in one house of your state legislature, you have committee hearings on it, all of that stuff is public, you have public recorded votes, it goes through both houses, goes up to the governor, and then is signed. You know, who did what, who voted where, who came up and spoke, you know, about this. That's how we pass laws in this country, and that's not how Common Core was passed, and I think that's really creepy. But maybe it's just me who gets upset about, you know, us being completely silent. So that's actually why we didn't hear a dang thing about Common Core until after it was all locked into place, after everything was signed. So if you look at this, is this my graph? No, this is a graph that I did. So I went and did LexisNexis. LexisNexis is this giant database of media. You know, all of the newspapers in the country and sometimes transcripts of TV shows. And so I went and looked according to year for whether, for any news articles that mentioned Common Core. And during the time that it was being signed and passed into place, that's 2008, we'll be generous and say 2011, although most states were locked in by 2010. You had basically nothing. That's to the green point. And even in 2012, you know, a year after everything was locked in and it was starting to roll out into schools, we have very negligible mentions. And then once it started rolling out into schools, parents and teachers freaked out and started making an issue. And then finally newspapers decided to cover it. Thanks, guys. You know, I actually literally had a conversation, I think it was in 2013, you know, with a reporter for a large education, or Education Week is like the trade education publication, about why, and he's like, well, it's not really news. I'm like, okay, wholesale change of the American education system isn't news. It's only news when parents decide to complain about it. And my research here, my LexisNexis search, is we're backed up by a journal article that was done later by a pair of researchers for the American Enterprise Institute. They found basically the same thing. Here's their graph. So again, even if you, I mean, and again, I was an education reporter. I didn't hear about this until I think 2012 when a mom called me up and said, I can't get into, you know, the state meeting, this hearing about these new education standards in my state. I thought they were public, like maybe you can go because you're a reporter. Took me 4 months of chasing around people and asking them to get access for them to finally say, no, you can't, you can't come. Okay, thanks guys. So, okay, sorry. So, and of course, I mean, this was all done for our good. They just had our best interest at heart, all of these people who didn't bother to ask us whether this is what we wanted or have any public notice and comment and the usual forms for this. We were promised that this was going to be a miracle worker for American kids. I have just a couple of quotes. Here's Jeb Bush. To compete with the rest of the world, we have to make sure that the skills they are learning are aligned with what employers and colleges expect high school graduates to know. The Common Core State Standards set an ambitious and voluntary goal line. Those of you who followed any of this were aware that Bush was one of the huge early major promoters of Common Core, especially to Republicans. Here's President Obama. We will end what has become a race to the bottom in our schools and instead spur a race to the top by encouraging better standards and assessments. Here's Bill Gates. It will be great if our education stuff worked, but we probably won't know for a decade. Thanks, Bill Gates. Who appointed you education czar? That's what I want to know. So, here's a decade later. Was he right? The short answer is no. So NAEP is a national test that has no stakes attached to it. So there's no incentive. Their teachers aren't judged by these. This is just a purely diagnostic test that has been around for about 20 years, highly respected, very high quality test. And what the graph shows is the top is reading scores. It only tests grades 4, 8, and sometimes 12. Reading scores for grades 4 and 8 on the top, and math grades 4 and 8 on the bottom. And what you see is a decline in the both grades' reading scores post-Common Core, as well as and just one statistically non-noticeable increase in grade 4 math. But you'll notice, and I'll show you some graphs later, is that under No Child Left Behind, even though I think it's bad legislation, and the panic it created did seem to have an effect on kids' test scores, increasing them, and so therefore Common Core reversed an increase in education progress from the past decade. Here's another way of looking at that. The first, so these are grouped according to racial subgroups. On the bottom, it's white, black, Hispanic kids, white, black, Hispanic kids over there, and the different bars are grade 4 reading, grade 4 math, grade 8 reading, grade 8 math. So a bunch of researchers came and took a look at that. So here's the increases that all those kids made before Common Core. And here's their scores after Common Core on that same test. Wow. Here is the we have had no change in high school graduations on the NAEP since the 1970s. Common Core has done nothing to do that. Has affected that not one bit. Here's you can see the graph going all the way back to 1971 through 2012. And the latest results from NAEP don't show any improvement. Here's one of my favorite studies. I think it was just done last year. Federal researchers have found that Common Core has damaged student achievement. So what they did was use kind of mathematical jujitsu to look at and estimate how kids would have done without Common Core, and then they looked and compared it to how kids actually did over Common Core, and how they would have done is the red line that you see above the dropping black line below on the end of the graph. They were completely surprised by these findings. They were expecting to prove with their report that Common Core helped kids. All of you are probably familiar with the ACT. It's a college entrance exam. Post Common Core, the kids' achievement and college preparedness is at a 20-year low. This is the graduating class of 2018. The ACT also finds that high school graduates are the worst prepared for college in 15 years. Thanks, Bill Gates. And then here's a check at an international comparison. I think these are for fourth grade reading scores on an international test. Again, no stakes here, nothing related to teachers. There's no reason for people to, you know, fudge on this test. American kids, as you see, were going up, and now they've all declined after Common Core. That's the last last 2 points on the graph there. Oh, and this is one of my favorites. Common Core takes away the requirement for California, among a number of states, had made algebra in eighth grade the default. So if you were remedial, you didn't have to take it, but if the average kid was taking algebra in eighth grade, that was seen as a huge national success story and encouraged other states to follow. Well, here, Common Core delays algebra to ninth, 10th grade. And the people were saying, oh, well, California can continue to keep kids in eighth grade. Common Core doesn't ban them from that. Yeah, that's not what happened. And the same thing happened in advanced math achievement. Here, these are the scores reversing on calculus test takers in California right after Common Core took effect. Happened for all different racial subgroups. So in other words, it's not just minority kids, it's everybody. It's definitely tied to curriculum, it's not something else going on. And you can't blame teachers for this. You can't say, oh, teachers weren't doing what Common Core said, because study after study after study finds that teachers made huge amounts of changes in their curriculum in order to do exactly what Common Core said. They were good, they obeyed, they did what was told to them. And so you can't say, oh, this is just because teachers, you know, Common Core is really great, but teachers haven't learned how to teach it. No, teachers were doing what they were told, and what they were told hurt kids. And here's one of my favorite ones. So this is just, as you see, the top says inflation-adjusted federal K-12 spending per pupil versus the achievement in 17-year-olds, how it has changed since 1970. Basically, American graduates are doing no better in the past 50 years, and the blue line is federal spending. Probably don't have to tell you anything else about that graph. It speaks for itself. So, what are some clues? Here we go. Okay, I don't think we'll go into that. I'll just leave that up and you can take a look at it. Oh, by the same, well, and for me, obviously, I mean, test scores are one thing, and I do, achievement absolutely matters. So, for example, researchers have found that if kids just did 2 or 3 points better in math, on their math achievement, the American economy would be trillions larger every single year. I mean, to the point that we'd be able to erase our federal deficits. So those of you who know what federal deficits are, and you know, and can think about the, you know, gross domestic product, you know, we're just leaving. If kids, American kids' achievement were just lifted to the level of kids in Canada, America's hat, you know, if we did as good as kids in Canada, you know, our economy would be much bigger, and we would have a lot more resources that we really need because our federal government is in major trouble. But compounded on top of that academic problem, you know, there's increasing negative views of America among American kids. And I'll just leave that up there while I talk about drawing some conclusions from what I think all of this means, the Common Core story. But basically, all of this data, to me, shows that Common Core was a massive waste of time and money. So, I mean, teachers spent hours and hours and all these, hours going to development and redoing their curriculum. And then, you know, there was a lot of transition time with kids in schools as this all phased in, and it cost billions of dollars. And American kids are doing worse after all of that effort. I think that's a national disgrace, and it should discredit all of the people who told us that Common Core was going to do the opposite. Obviously, their credentials are worthless. And nobody should listen them to get to them again. And said a lot of them have positions of even greater power. David Coleman, known as the architect of Common Core, he's now in charge of the College Board, which runs the SAT and the Advanced Placement. So there's a number of Common Core supporters that have high places in the U.S. Education Department under President Trump. And I don't think, this wasn't the first time that American kids have been screwed over by federal programs, and it's not going to be the last. And one of the things that I think Common Core does that plays into our larger political conversations nowadays is it delegitimizes American elites and public education. These people are supposed to be the experts. They told us they were doing this for our own good, and their ideas are a massive failure. And we are left stuck with the kids who didn't learn and paying for that, which is completely unfair. And we never had a chance in the beginning to say whether we wanted to opt into all of this. So and we see this combination of massive failure and a refusal to acknowledge it at all levels of our government. For example, the architects of the Iraq War, right? It's another kind of example of all the people who think, oh, well, I have a degree from Harvard. I've had this position. Yeah, well, you know, your ideas are crap. You know, you hurt people with them and you spend a lot of our money and put us into deficits. And I think that the whole Common Core mess really illustrates what I think is the political battle of our times, which is the people versus the deep state, the people versus the administrative state, the power struggle between we the people and the people who take our money and our kids and our society and our institutions and run them into the ground and profit handsomely off it and go laughing all the way to the bank while we're left with this mess. So I have another handout today that I have has some ideas for what I think about what to do about all of this. And again, as I mentioned last night, one of the big ones has been, going through all of this, so I spent a lot of time with the whole Common Core. There were thousands of moms across the country who did all the right things to try to get Common Core repealed. They went to their state boards of education. They had rallies. They went to their state legislature. They went to their governors. They showed up. They worked their rear ends off. You know, they worked themselves exhausted, and none of it changed. Nobody listened to them. You know, nothing changed, and they were right. You know, American kids are hurt as a consequence, and we spent all of this money. And so that was it was an eye-opening moment for me, because until then I had believed, as I mentioned last night, that our political institutions are receptive to what the American people want. And so I no longer believe that largely to be the case. And I think, again, we have to start thinking about what our strategy is going to be that is different in order to not keep going to our state legislatures and school boards of education. Now, I had a woman, ask me today, does that mean we should just give up on politics and what do? Just think it's all corrupt? No, I think I call it the Nehemiah strategy. I think we should do both and. I think we should both be involved in politics and voting, getting good people into positions where we can, primarying, bad representatives, doing that. So that's, Nehemiah is the story of the guy who went to rebuild Jerusalem, and all of his people were armed with swords while they were building up the city walls. So that I consider the sword part, keep off my lawn, people. I don't want gay drag queens in my local public library. I'm going to protest over that. Showing up to those public meetings. No, you're not going to spend money on this thing. It's a ridiculous waste of time. I don't want one-on-one iPads for my kids. So that's the sword part of it. But we can't just do the sword part of it, because obviously the barbarians are inside the city gates and they control the public purse. So I also think, as I said last night, we need to be thinking about what we're going to do to make sure that our kids and our institute, we have I really think we need to, in my mind, I'm just going to say it. So if you think I'm crazy, it's all right. I think we need to build what I call in my mind a parallel society. So we need parallel institutions. We need ones that are new, that are fresh, that are places where people can go to get their needs met, that are not controlled by bureaucrats who obviously don't care about the needs of the people, to have good citizens, to have good education, to have all kinds of things. The poor in our communities need to be taken care of, for a completely different issue, and they shouldn't be, at the mercy of an administrative state that doesn't care about them and gets terrible outcomes for them and increases their opioid addiction, for example, by just constantly giving them, treatments and treatments and treatments and cushioning the blows of their fall. So, in every single aspect of society, I think we need to start building the walls, replacing the functions of government, because our government is corrupt and can't do them very well. And obviously what that looks like is going to be different for every family and community. You have different resources, you have different, local institutions that work and don't work. You have even different, you know, local conditions for who's on your school board and whatever. So I can't give a blanket thing, but I have a number of ideas and recommendations in my handout. And the one that I really want to highlight, and that's the only one I'll talk about, and you can just read the rest yourself, is something that I call the Boomer Brigade. So I named it this because a lot of us young parents who have a lot of, even not a lot of little, any little kids at all, if you are at my stage in life, it is really hard for you to do institution building because you're just trying to keep your kids all together, right? You're trying to put food on the table, get your kids medical care when they fall out of the tree. And, you know, if you're lucky, if you can follow up their homework, you know, maybe, you know, both parents are working or whatever. You know, it's a very, very high stress, high demand time of life. And that limits our ability to show up, you know, to and solve this problem ourselves. We really need people at different stages of their lives to really care about our interests and our kids and our generation, people whose kids are grown up or people who don't have kids yet and therefore have the free time and the money to be able, you know, either or both and, either free time and money, to be investing that and helping create a culture for us that in which our kids are safe and in which our kids are being taught to love America and actually know how to do math. And so I call it the Boomer Brigade because I see a lot of times people spending their resources and their money on stuff that I don't think people are aware of where we are necessarily in the state of our society. I don't think they're aware how bad things are because their kids aren't in school anymore. You know, they are not at the library looking at the children's picture book section. And, you know, one of the primary example of mine is there's this large Christian foundation in my hometown. It has billions of dollars, and they give them in grants to local organizations. They give their grants to things like comfort dogs for that travel around to different schools. And I am not against comfort dogs. I love dogs. Dogs are great. However, I feel like we're in a crisis here. We need money to be moving to people who have much more acute needs than to pet a dog that you can get for free at the Humane Society. You know, and that for me is kind of the epitome of misallocated resources, not understanding the times that we're in. Move that money into something that is much more mission critical. And so part of my job here today is to show you how bad it is and to encourage you to, because of how bad things are, to be, if you're on a nonprofit board, if you're on, you know, it's a church committee, my handout has a lot of specific things, you know, you can do to start acting like you realize what day it is and how bad things are, because I'm worried about where the country is and where it's going, and I don't think our country is going to make it much longer if people don't start cluing in. All right, now I'm done.
Question.
Yeah.
Wait a second. Okay. We'll have some question answer. I wanted to ask you, have you by chance ever met Jeff and Philip Odds to any of you?
No, but I know a number of ABF people.
Yeah. Jeff runs the
Blackstone Institute.
Hmm. Been here twice. And he talks about the fact that Christians might have to live like when they went to the Babylonian captivity. And they didn't just sit there and lick their wounds. They learned how to thrive. And we need to think about that, because it goes along so well. And what I'm really saying is, we need to do something. And as long as I'm talking about doing something, some of you have not been through, again, how many of you have been through the Truth Project? Raise your hands. I've been a Christian for 45 years. I've been a pastor, and I've done this for 10 years. I've done some other things. Nothing that I've seen has been as impactful as the Truth Project. We wouldn't be doing this today if it hadn't been for Del Tiger and the Truth Project. If you haven't done that, if you haven't done that in your homes, I encourage you to do that. This is the next one. This is going to take us from, why did Jesus come? To why did he leave? I promise you, these are in the back, desk. We're going to have Dale and his team here to train the trainers. In other words, people that want to have this in their home. And try and teach people how to engage the culture when we ain't apparently winning. So pick up one of these. If you can